From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson today. This is Here and Now. And major developments this morning in Austin, Texas, where police say the man responsible for a series of deadly bombings blew himself up early this morning inside his vehicle as a SWAT team closed in. The man has been identified as 23-year-old Mark Anthony Condit. Interim Police Chief Brian Manley said today that residents should not let their guard down, even though the suspect is dead.
We still need to remain vigilant to ensure that no other packages or devices have been left through the community. So as we go through the day today, we want the community to remain vigilant. We do not know where he has been in the past 24 hours. And again, if you see something that looks suspicious, if you see something that's out of place, if you see something that gives you concern, call 911 and let us know.
Reporter Matt Largy is covering this story for KUT in Austin. Matt, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Sounds like a very dramatic end to a story that's been developing now for 19 days. What happened in those final moments?
So what we know was early this morning, police confronted the suspect. They confronted him in his vehicle. As they did that, he began to drive away, and police pursued him. He drove into a ditch along the highway here, and as police approached his vehicle, he detonated a bomb, and at the same time, police also fired their weapons at him, and ultimately he died.
So police have said over the last 24 hours or so that they were actually able to get a lot more evidence on this suspect. The case sort of picked up momentum because he was seen on security video dropping off one of those packages at a FedEx store. What else have we learned about the suspected bomber? Anything?
So we do know a few things. I mean, details are still pretty sketchy at this point. He was 23 years old. He lived in an Austin suburb called Pflugerville, lived not too far away from his parents. He was homeschooled as a child. He went to the local community college for several years, did not graduate. We know that he worked at a semiconductor company. And beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about him.
Right. So, and those bombs were considered to be pretty advanced. Anything so far in his background to suggest why he'd have the expertise to build them?
Well, the only thing that we could tell is that he did have some exposure to electronics working at a semiconductor company.
Yeah.
But beyond that, we're just still not sure.
Well, we heard your police chief there warning people to stay vigilant. Even though the suspect is dead, they don't know where he was over the last 24 hours or so. There could still be a bomb that he placed somewhere before he died. What are people thinking about that? I mean, is there still this idea that that this isn't over?
I get the sense from people that people do feel some sense of relief. However, officials are not feeling that same relief. It still feels like things are very much on edge here. I know here a short time ago, I went outside of my office here. We work next to the University of Texas campus, and there were officers with bomb-sniffing dogs going around the campus. Just as they said, when I asked them, just kind of a heightened level of vigilance. Nothing to worry about here, but just trying to be trying to take precautions.
And again, I know we're at the stage of an investigation where we still have so many questions, but obviously people are wondering about a motive here. There were some ideas that this could have been racially motivated at the very beginning, but it seems like people have backed off that after, as we've seen the makeup of some of the victims. Any idea about motive?
No, police still are not saying or do not know what the motive is. I do know that right now they are searching his home in Pflugerville outside of Austin, and so they may find some clues as to what the motive was when they do that.
Matt, just finally, this was obviously a nightmare for the community there. Very tense times. You mentioned there's a feeling of relief. I mean, just talk more about that.
Well, I get the sense that people were, you know, they were waiting for this to happen. They were in effect waiting for the next bomb to come. In fact, last night there was what turned out to be a false alarm.
Yep.
There was a small explosion at a Goodwill store that turned out to be not connected, but people are very relieved now.
All right. Matt Largy, KUT, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And let's get an update now on the sexual abuse of young athletes by the former Olympic gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. Nassar will likely spend the rest of his life in prison, but survivors say their fight isn't over. Some 140 of his victims are suing his former employer, Michigan State University. MSU says it didn't know about Nassar's abuse, even though several women say they reported it years ago. So far, the only financial support MSU is giving survivors is a $10 million fund to pay for their therapy. And as Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports, to get that financial aid, victims are required to call a law firm in Boston.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, is this Bernie?
This is Bernie, yes.
Yeah, Bernie. Hey, Bernie Fitzgerald is with the Boston-based law firm Commonwealth Mediation and Conciliation. At $700 an hour, Fitzgerald and his colleagues have been hired by Michigan State University. Their job, administer the school's $10 million healing assistance fund. Bernie Fitzgerald says he knows that it's intimidating for these survivors to just cold call an unknown guy in Boston asking for money for therapy.
And certainly it's confusing for them. And honestly, there's a lot of them that have been tentative as to taking that first step.
This fund is basically a pot of money MSU has promised to help Nassar's victims cover their therapy and counseling bills. And if you watch these women and girls face their former sports doctor during his recent criminal sentencings, then you know that their trauma takes a lot of different forms.
For me, it was a girl wanting the pain to stop so badly that she woke up for months to the thought, I want to die.
I've had graphic nightmares about the defendant, paralyzed in my sleep, unable to scream, while he puts his hands on me again.
Someone asked me not too long ago when the last time I was happy was, to tell them a story about the last time I was truly happy and had fun. I couldn't.
That was Kyle Stevens, Bailey Lawrenson, and Taylor Livingston. And if you are a survivor of Nassar's abuse who wants to use this MSU therapy fund, the school has set up this one-page website. It's got a 24-hour hotline to call if you need a referral in your area. And if you want to actually get reimbursed for the cost of your therapy through this $10 million fund, then there is contact info for Bernie Fitzgerald.
I called Bernie the first hour the fund became available. I was going to get all my money back for all those bills.
This is Melody Postuma. She's 22 years old. She and her husband live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We talked to her over Skype. And she says starting at age 13, she was abused by Nassar at his MSU clinic. Paying for counseling this last year and a half has not been easy. She had to borrow money from her parents, which put strain on their relationship. So when she hears about the MSU fund from her lawyer, she calls Bernie Fitzgerald and sends him her therapy receipts. Fitzgerald looks at her name and sees if she's on a list MSU put together of student athletes and patients who may have seen Nassar over the years. And then a few days later, Melody Postuma gets a check in the mail. Suddenly, Postuma says she was able to help her parents with their medical bills.
It was really great to send them that money. And I know that they were almost incredulous on the phone when I said, hey, you're going to get a couple $1,000 sent from me in a week.
Of some 200 women and girls who have filed complaints about Nassar, between 65 to 75 have at least reached out to Fitzgerald to ask about the fund. They often feel overwhelmed and confused by this whole process and figuring out how this whole fund thing actually works. For example, MSU says the fund is just for survivors and their parents. But Fitzgerald says if your, say, spouse needs counseling as a result of your abuse and a mental health professional gives the okay, then this fund will cover that too.
Absolutely. If the mental health professional defined it as such, then yes.
The same goes for holistic treatments or therapy dogs, Fitzgerald says, which is very good news for Melody Postuma and Beacon, her therapy dog.
We're still working on the potty training, but outside of that, he's just been super fun to bring him to the market and coffee shops.
Still, there are those who are skeptical about this healing assistance fund, including attorney John Manley, who represents many of Nassar's victims.
This wasn't a fund designed to benefit the victims. It was a fund designed to give Michigan State public relations cover.
One thing Manley is worried about particularly is the fund's confidentiality, that MSU won't access or use these women's personal information against them in the civil case. Bernie Fitzgerald promises that all this information is confidential, and MSU says the same thing on its website. Still, Manley is not convinced.
It's the one organization in the country that no one should trust its word about when it comes to sexual abuse. And if they say, well, it's on our website, well, yeah, Volkswagen had on its website that its diesels were clean.
Meanwhile, lawyers like Manley are fighting with MSU to settle more than 140 civil lawsuits over Nassar's abuse. And Manley says $10 million for therapy bills is not going to be enough to make up for what these women and girls went through. Michigan State University, however, has asked a judge to dismiss their lawsuits. For Here and Now, I'm Kate Wells in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Quick note, the fourth nor'easter in the past 3 weeks is hitting the east on this, the first full day of spring. Snow started falling last night in West Virginia and Kentucky. Today, the mid-Atlantic, including D.C. And by later today, it will blanket New York and New England. Airlines have already canceled thousands of flights. Amtrak has scaled back service on the Northeast Corridor, so travelers take note. Schools are well aware of the weather. If they're open, kids are probably not out in the playgrounds. Although there are schools starting to send bundled kids out to play in the cold, it's part of a move to get kids to take more risks. Advocates say riskier play reduces bullying and obesity and teaches kids balance and decision-making that reduces injuries when they become adults. They say there's been a sterilization of play, partly because of the way it's regulated. Let's back up. There's a Consumer Product Safety Commission that collects injury data so they can figure out which kinds of play equipment cause injuries. But our next guest says that shows the injuries, but not why they happen. You know, was a kid on an age-appropriate swing? Was mulch raked? Because if not, it can harden like cement. And she says no one is accounting for a balance between risk and the many benefits. In Britain, there's been a government-down move to change this way of thinking. Some schools throwing away those plastic playhouses and bringing in 2x4s, crates, loose bricks, using knives with adult supervision, fire pits. And American designers are paying attention. In Washington, there's a playground at a private school, Beauvoir, that has a zip line, wobbly wooden bridges, rope tunnels between giant wood towers. So what can public schools do? Bambi Yost is an associate professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University. Bambi, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
From your point of view, what is the concern?
Well, I would say one of the concerns is that children aren't necessarily pushing themselves as much as they could be. Some of that's because of overprotective parents. Some of it's because of regulations or restrictions in school settings. Some of it's because they don't necessarily know how to challenge themselves in fun, risk-taking ways that can lead to really positive outcomes for them as adults, you know, where they're more innovative and creative and more likely to take risks alone or with others.
So, for instance, we're seeing schools, and this again is in the UK, it's not just in the playgrounds, in the classrooms too. A teacher talking about there would be knives with adult supervision, but they're also putting back sharp-edged tape dispensers because, as one teacher said, well, they usually only cut themselves once. And then you learn that you could cut yourselves on those things. Is that part of it, too, learning the consequences of certain things?
Absolutely. We don't necessarily want to encourage them to potentially harm themselves. But the beauty is that kids are incredibly good. You know, they fall down. They get back up and they continue to do that sort of thing over and over again. And those are all really big skills that they need to learn at a very young age, especially with balance, for example, so that they're better balanced later in life.
Well, in fact, you and Megan Talarowski, another American landscape designer, Megan gathered data from London in 2015. She went to these parks that we talked about that the government's actually changing. They have signs in front of some of these parks saying, we're making these parks riskier, you know, to, as a warning. What did Megan find?
Well, you know, Megan has done extensive research in the UK, and I work with her in Philadelphia. She's the director of Studio Ludo. Most of the play environments that she saw there, you know, their kids are being exposed to much more opportunities for challenging environments than what we have here. They can play with sand. They can run around with tools, pieces of wood. You know, they can build things. In the United States, we're so risk adverse and it's such a litigious society that we tend to shift away from things like that. Unless it's a privately run organization or a place that has a lot of monitoring and supervision.
We can understand why, because some of the things you're talking about, workbenches with hammers and saws, mud pits, you know, are any public schools doing this?
We've had some moderate success just recently here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Megan worked with us at a school called Nebinger Elementary School. It's a K through 8. And there's a science teacher there, Javier Dominguez, who's awesome. What they're doing at that schoolyard is they have an EPA stormwater garden that has been underutilized because, again, fear of children getting injured in a natural play environment. And this past fall, my students from Iowa State University went with me to Philadelphia, and we assisted the 6th through 8th graders at the school with Javier. All of us worked together to actually prune and thin out the stormwater garden so that kids could have this experience of being in a naturalized setting. And the thing that is really unique about this school is Javier is not afraid to let them use tools. And so in the classroom, he has support from the administration down that allows him to have them building bird boxes. And so they built these birdhouse boxes. They have a solar-powered roof that has a little tiny camera in it so that they can see what the birds are doing.
This all sounds wonderful, but it's even more organized than what we're seeing in some of these playgrounds in Britain. I mean, just putting loose bricks around. I can just see a teacher. I mean, obviously that the hope would be the kids would build with it, but you know a kid's going to pick it up and throw it at another kid. And so who's liable there?
This is what's interesting. So we actually did introduce more loose materials. And I think people take for granted that plant materials are not loose, but they are. Meaning that, you know, a lot of times we're not allowed to put fruit trees in schoolyards, for example, because people are afraid that they're going to throw, you know, a giant apple at somebody. But what we did at this school as well is we worked with the Fairmont Recycling Program where they have trees. And my students and I went there and we literally handpicked big hardwood trees that I taught my students how to use chainsaws, actually.
Oh,
they were all moving huge tree stumps. We cut them down to the best of our ability and then we took them to the school and the 6th and 8th graders helped us unload everything. And then we did more chainsawing at the school. And so part of what we were doing was working with the kids to figure out what we needed. And in addition, we were also then providing loose parts. So little tiny discs that are essentially cut sections off of tree limbs are really fun because you can stack them, you can build with them. And this school in particular has a relatively high autistic population. So autistic kids really need hands-on experiential learning and opportunities to enhance their fine motor skills, to touch materials, and it actually encourages them to interact with others. So we had autistic children out helping us place these stumps all over that entire EPA stormwater garden. So what's nice about it is it's not permanent. So it's less threatening to a school district because if there is an incident and something happens where a kid falls off of one of the logs, they can remove it.
Lucky school that has, you know, you and others coming in to do this. But it sounds like you're saying, don't be afraid of putting in a big sandbox or a big pit with dirt and a lot of shovels or some pieces of 2x4.
Absolutely.
And just let kids do with them what they may.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I see the most in an urban area in particular, is that kids don't necessarily understand how the world works in terms of ecosystems, digging, you know, having that freedom to explore the physical earth around us. You know, I grew up in a rural setting. I took for granted the fact that I was able to go to a creek, build a dam, catch frogs, do whatever I wanted all day long, and then come home for dinner. Kids rarely get to do that anymore. Very few children today are considered free range, meaning that they can just go and do what they want to and have full autonomy. And with that autonomy comes self-regulation. You take more risks, but you can also then incrementally challenge yourself. So kids that are in a highly urbanized setting with limited natural or naturalized areas really don't have exposure to that unless we provide it for them.
Yeah. I just want to ask one last thing. Surfaces. Mm-hmm. It used to be you just had asphalt and kids would fall off swing sets and it was not good in some occasions. And then we started getting the mulch. And then now there's almost, I was at a playground the other day, completely tiled with these sort of rubber tiles. Mm-hmm. You almost bounce on them throughout the whole playground. I can see parents saying, isn't this wonderful? No skin knees. You say what?
I say it's expensive.
It
is wonderful in the sense that kids are not falling and injuring themselves at the same rate necessarily. And poured-in-place rubber is awesome because you can add color and it looks cool and it's a bouncy surface. And it does, in fact, encourage kids to roll and tumble a little bit more on those surfaces. But at the same time, it's not 100% guarantee that your child won't break an arm. And it's also, again, limiting them to understand what it's like to scrape your knee, to know that not all surfaces, when you fall out of them, are in fact safe and soft. Kids who grow up with grass underneath a swing set, for example, learn pretty quickly that if they jump off of that swing set, they in fact will injure themselves. Kids who've only been on a poured-in-place rubber surface that jump off are less likely to injure themselves. But then if they go to another, you know, park-like setting or somebody's backyard and they do the same thing, they're more likely to injure themselves there. And so what we've seen is you have higher rates of injury actually in your neighbor's backyard than you would at any public park or public schoolyard.
Because you're so protected. Plus, there's that stunning realization, what? Life hurts? Bambi Yost, an associate professor of landscape architecture at Iowa State University on new thinking about bringing risk into playgrounds and classrooms. Bambi, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
So readers commented when the New York Times wrote about riskier playgrounds. Here's a couple. I remember thinking padded playgrounds were overkill. Then I saw a four-year-old fall backwards off a swing. If not for padding, he might have been killed. Here's another. If someone asked about bricks, isn't there something between foam and a brick? So we want your thoughts. What's your school doing? Leave a comment at hereandnow.org.
The Minneapolis police officer who killed a woman last July in a dark alley outside her home has been charged with murder. Officer Muhammad Noor turned himself in yesterday. He's scheduled to appear in court today. Justine Ruzchek Damond was unarmed when she was shot. She had called police to report what she thought was a sexual assault near her home. Joining us now is Minnesota Public Radio's Reham Fashir. And Reham, how is the community responding to these charges?
Well, obviously, activists were asking for charges, were demanding charges. It's been 8 long months for them, and they have been waiting for the investigation to be completed. And they are pleased with the charges, but they're also aware that a charge doesn't mean a conviction. And the end result that they want is a conviction against the police officer who shot Justine Ruzchek.
And Reham, what is the police officer's defense in this case going to be? It was a complicated situation. They were in an alley behind this woman's house. It was dark. It was late at night. And the officers, there were two of them in the squad car when this happened, said they heard a loud noise and they were scared.
Right. So one of the officers has spoken so far, Matthew Harity. He was Noor's partner at the time. And he had said that he, according to the criminal complaint, he had said that he did fear for his life. But we have not heard from Officer Noor. He has not given a statement. He is inserting his Fifth Amendment right not to self-incriminate. So we're not sure exactly what his defense will be. But we know that from previous shootings, officers have discretion to shoot if they have reasonable fear.
I also know that this shooting caused a major stir in the city, as you might expect. The mayor fired the chief of police. There were big questions about the use of body cameras. I understand that that policy shifted after this.
That's right. There were a lot of changes immediately after the shooting. The police chief was actually gone at the time of the shooting. She had been out of town. So it was hard for her to defend the shooting. She straight up said, you know, Justine did not have to die, which is kind of a deviation from what we've seen in the past, where police officers are usually kind of defended by their union leaders and their police chiefs. In this case, there has been some changes in the department in terms of the leadership, but also in terms of the body camera policy. As you noted, the officers did not have their body cameras on. They didn't have any dash cam footage of the shooting. So this really prompted a lot of questions about the practices in the department in terms of body camera usage. So now every police officer is required to turn on their body camera in pretty much every call that they respond to.
Of course, your area has seen this sort of story before. In 2016, Philando Castile was shot outside of Minneapolis. Of course, that case got huge national attention. The police officer who shot Castile was acquitted. Is there a sense there that finding justice in this case from the family's perspective and getting a conviction against this officer will be difficult?
Yeah, I think that's always on the family's mind, and that's always on the activist's mind because of what we've seen in the past. A charge, again, is not a conviction. And it's also very difficult to prove the type of charges that officers usually face. So in this case, he is facing a third-degree murder charge and a second-degree manslaughter charge. The prosecutors will have to prove that Officer Neuer had a depraved mind when he shot Justine Ruschek, and that he was culpably negligent. So we know that those charges are very difficult to prove and are hard for the jury to kind of wrap their mind around.
All right, we're going to keep following this story. Reham Fashir, a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And a surprising statement today from North Korea. State-run media says moves to ease tensions over its nuclear weapons program are a peace offensive. The statement also rejects criticism that the recent shift toward diplomacy is a sign that U.S. sanctions are working. This is the first time that there has been any comment from North Korea since President Trump said he would meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The BBC's Laura Bicker joins us now from Seoul. And Laura, how should we be reading into what North Korea is saying today?
Well, I think we've been watching the state-run media since Donald Trump announced that he would speak to Kim Jong-un. And we've been just wondering when there would be, or if there would be, any kind of shift in the language, shift in the tone. Remember, every single time these broadcasts and these commentaries come out, they're usually very anti-American. They talk about the imperialists. They talk about them in very colourful, unbroadcastable language. So we were looking to see if there was any change. And today we've had that. Now, the words that we're looking for came out. So peace-loving proposal was what the editorial had to say, and it said it had caused a sign of change in Pyongyang's relationship with the United States. So that's what we saw. And they said that it wasn't to do with any of the sanctions, any of the international pressure coming from the United States, Japan, or any of the international community. So they're saying this is our proposal, this is our peace-loving nature that has made this take place.
So Laura, I just want to make sure I understand you, because there was some skepticism here in the United States about these talks between the White House and Kim Jong-un, because North Korea had gone so long without saying anything, without publicly acknowledging it. Is this seen as an acknowledgement that the talks will happen?
I think when you look at the broadcast and look at the commentary, there has been absolutely no mention of any summit. There hasn't even been any mention of the summit between President Moon from here in South Korea and Kim Jong-un, which will take place at the end of April. So now to hear this kind of first time it's mentioned a shift in North Korean policy towards the US, that's what we're hearing. But we're not hearing anything about summits. We're not hearing anything about giving up nuclear weapons. We're just hearing this shift in tone. And that's important because that's what's going out to the population. But what we are seeing is a flurry of activity. We've seen the foreign minister head to Sweden to talk to his counterpart there. Now, that's important because Sweden represents Washington in Pyongyang.
Because we have no diplomatic relationship with the country.
That's right, exactly right. You have no embassy in right. Pyongyang. So Sweden represents your interest there. And when it comes to perhaps the likes of the three American prisoners in North Korea, we know that was discussed over the weekend. Plus, there's this flurry of activity between North and South Korea.
Okay, so some hints that things are starting to happen, but there is another point of contention here, and that's the joint military exercises that we know are now on between the U.S. and South Korea is going to happen next month. The North has always called these drills a provocation. Does the fact that they're going to happen put any future negotiations at risk or make them more complicated?
When those military drills start, this will be a test. If there's any reaction from Pyongyang, I can imagine it will not be taken very well. So I think they'll know if they are genuine about sitting down and talking with both South Korea and with the US. I don't think we'll see any missile tests anytime soon.
Is there a sense of optimism in South Korea? Just a few months ago, it seemed like the two countries were at the brink of war. You had Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un having their own war of words. There were these nuclear tests happening consistently. What is the feeling there? Is there optimism this time?
I'll tell you this story. When Donald Trump announced that he was going to speak to Kim Jong-un, when it was the South Koreans announced it on the White House lawn, I was lucky enough to be with a family who are divided. Their family are still in the north, they're here in the south. And they just cried. The tears just started rolling down their face because this is a huge moment for them. This is the hope that after so many years, they may finally see the other half of their family again. And if it breaks down, I think there will be a lot of people very disappointed, and they learn to live with the optimism, but know that at the back of their mind, everything could fall apart. So,
right.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
So cautious optimism there in Seoul. The BBC's Laura Bicker. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
And now a story about a tree that you have probably never heard of, the moringa. The hardy, fast-growing tree has bright green leaves and long seed pods, which have been harvested for centuries in places like India and the Philippines because they're very nutritious. KQED's Katrina Schwartz takes us to Fresno, California, where Hmong farmers hope to capitalize on what could become a new superfood trend in the U.S.
The thick, low-lying fog is just starting to burn off when I first set eyes on Kaying Mua's moringa farm.
Okay. So right now, they are dormant at this time.
Because it's winter, not their growing season, moringa doesn't like the cold, a problem for farmers here in the Central Valley. The rows and rows of trees are short, only a few feet high, and they're covered in thick white plastic to keep the roots warm.
In the March depends the weather. So we're going to open and then going to shoot like it's crazy.
Moringa is kind of a magical tree. It doesn't need much water, flourishes in poor sandy soil, loves the heat, and grows incredibly fast.
They will shoot 1 inch per night.
In one summer, moringa can grow from a seed to an 8-foot-tall tree, bushy with green leaves. When the pods mature, they can get up to 3 feet long and look like supersized fava beans.
I'm the main one. Did the dirt.
Yeah, my mom gets to do the dirty work.
Kaying's got a partner in this moringa adventure, her son Sam.
I love working with, you know, these type of projects with my mom.
Growing moringa is just one of many mother-son projects they've tackled over the years. They've grown rare flowers and hit the road selling Hmong crafts. But Sam says moringa is different. It could be a game changer for their small operation.
And we're trying to pioneer something that's never been done before.
The Muas already distribute fresh moringa leaves to Asian markets around California, but they're looking to cash in on a much bigger market.
Hi there. I'm looking for moringa. Can you show me where that is?
Moringa. Be Alive Vitamins is in Fresno. Owner Monica Wilson says she's carried moringa for a few years now, but notices the demand is increasing.
People are using it for anything from blood sugar management to keeping their cholesterol at a healthy level. It's very high in antioxidants.
Scientists are still studying the many nutritional claims about the so-called superfood, but the early evidence is promising. Moringa is packed with protein, vitamins A and C, calcium, iron, and zinc. Wilson imports her moringa from India, one of the biggest sources, but she'd rather get it locally.
Traceability of our product is really important, so the closer the better.
And Wilson will soon get closer to Fresno farmers like Kaying Mua through a University of California extension project. Lorena Ramos works with the extension program to help dozens of farmers get more out of their moringa.
The farmers usually sell it as the fresh product, either the leaf or the pod. But we are teaching them how to dry it and how to grind it and how to store it properly. And they're very excited to see that they can do so much more and also extend the life of the crop.
Ramos says this kind of value-added product could bring in more cash for farmers living on a thin margin. Kaying and her son Sam are her star students. They're ahead of the game because they built a greenhouse to give them a jump start on the growing season.
Temperature in here never drops below 70 degrees, even at nighttime.
Spindly moringa trees graze the 18-foot-high roof in this balmy greenhouse, a peaceful sauna on a chilly day.
But in the greenhouse, I can see the seed from the tree that I like to plant for the next year.
Kaying eats moringa every day and believes in its healing powers. She takes pride in what she grows and all the creative solutions she's found along the way. When she first started distributing fresh moringa for retail 3 years ago, picking and packing the leaves was a real puzzler.
And then my mom finally figured it out. And so she's a pretty smart lady.
Yeah. It's nice to have your son say that about you.
Oh, he always say, and everything we true.
This year, the warm, dry weather has the mother-son team expecting a bigger harvest than last year, and somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 in moringa profits. For Here and Now, I'm Katrina Schwartz in Fresno.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is planning to speak publicly in the next 24 hours, according to the news site Axios. His company has been getting tough backlash in the U.S. and Europe after news that the information of 50 million users was improperly obtained by the Steve Bannon-founded British-based Cambridge Analytica, the company that worked for the Donald Trump campaign and was co-founded by Republican donor Robert Mercer. Cambridge Analytica's Alexander Nix has been suspended, but reportedly he and Mercer's daughters are part of a new company that shares an address with Cambridge Analytica. Lots of players, so let's get a primer from NPR's Joanna Kakissis in London. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Robin.
And so remind us, who's Alexander Nix? How did he come to be involved with Steve Bannon and Robert Mercer?
So Alexander Nix is a man of privilege. He worked in finance for a time, and then he was wooed away into the world of big data. And who wooed him away? Steve Bannon. Mm-hmm. Steve Bannon introduced him to Robert Mercer, the computer scientist, hedge fund billionaire, and as you said, the big Republican donor. And we found more about this backstory from Charles Creel, who advises a British parliamentary committee on digital issues.
Steve Bannon reportedly, by happenstance, meets Nix, gets involved with the company, and then takes Nix and puts him together with Mercer. And suddenly you have Mercer's politics and his money combined with an ambitious company. So this storm was created.
And this storm is Cambridge Analytica, which was born in 2013.
Well, and we know what happened also is that a researcher applied to Facebook to have an app where they could ask questions of users, just a few thousand users, but they ended up hoovering up the information of 50 million users. That researcher gave that information to Cambridge Analytica. So was Nix suspended because of the Facebook hoovering or because of some of the revelations from the Channel 4 investigation that you've been seeing there in London?
So it was actually the Channel 4 investigation because, you know, there were some pretty damning things in this that Nick's talked about. He was filmed by a Channel 4 reporter who was posing as an associate of a wealthy Sri Lankan family. And this reporter filmed Nick's talking about using spies and beautiful women to entrap opponents of the political candidates the firm represents, perhaps in compromising positions.
Have a wealthy developer come in, somebody posing as a wealthy developer.
I'm a master of disguise.
Yes. They will offer a large amount of money to the candidate to finance his campaign in exchange for land, for instance. We'll have the whole thing recorded on cameras. Blank out the face of our guy, and we have posted on the internet.
So it'll on the Facebook or YouTube or something like this. It can be done.
Send some girls around to the candidate's house. We have lots of history of things.
And it sounded so seedy that the company was almost forced to respond. And what they did do in a statement is say something like, you know, this does not represent the values or operations of the firm because it is such bad global press for the firm. I mean, this film has been talked about all over the world. But, you know, experts have told us that it's, you know, highly unlikely that the board had no idea what was going on because Alexander Nix has been there since the beginning.
Look, and Cambridge Analytica has been well known in this country as well. We remember when Congressman Trey Gowdy was questioning Steve Bannon in hearings. And he asked Bannon, would it be treason for someone close to him, Bannon, to ask WikiLeaks for opposition research on Hillary Clinton? Bannon said that would be bad judgment. And then Gowdy held up emails from Cambridge Analytica, boasting of doing just that. Robert Mueller requested emails from the company last fall. But we understand that in Britain, investigations are going on about the company's role in the Brexit vote.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the Brexit vote is still very divisive here. People are still very divided about it. There has been talk all along about perhaps people were manipulated into voting to leave the European Union, perhaps by propaganda, by, you know, strongly influential messaging. And this is where this comes in, because Cambridge Analytica was involved with the Leave campaign, people are starting to talk now about, let's go back and look at that again. What did they do? How were they involved? How did the messages get to people, and did they affect a very critical vote for Britain?
Well, is the average person there, though, buzzing about it the way people are here because of the Facebook revelations?
I've been hearing a lot about this. When I'm like on the subway, I hear people talking about it. But what was really interesting was yesterday I went to the offices of Cambridge Analytica just to see what was going on. There were a bunch of reporters, you know, sitting outside taking pictures. And then I spotted this middle-aged guy. He was a tour guide, and he was putting up these handmade posters all over the windows outside the Cambridge Analytica offices. And the pictures were a photo of Alexander Nix, and he'd photoshopped these prison bars on over the face of Alexander Nix. And whoever walked by as he was putting, can you believe what you saw on Channel 4? Can you believe this happened? Mm. So, yeah, it is. People are talking about it a lot. People are pretty shocked.
Hmm. Well, unseemly is one thing, and we will see if it's illegal. NPR's Joanna Kakissis in London. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your thoughts on what you're hearing about Cambridge Analytica and its sway over elections are welcome at herenow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.